Okay, the recording has started. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Sam. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPC call on the 14th of August 2012. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, Michaela Nalan, Paul Diaz, James Bodell, Hugo de Falla, Angie Graves, Alain Béranger, Chris Chaplow, Kevin Erdman, and Bob Mountain. We have apologies for Matt Serlin, Simonetta Bataiga, Jonathan Tenenbaum, Roy Dykes, Barbara Knight, Avi Doria, and Marika Koenigs. From staff, we have Barry Cobb and myself, Matthew Peregrin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IRTPC Working Group call for August 14th, 2012. First off, I would note that we have a significant number of apologies this week, but it looks like we also have a fairly healthy and representative turnout for the call. So is there anyone that believes that we have not achieved a sufficient quorum to proceed? Please indicate so now. We can discuss that. Okay, good. I thought that was the case as well. It looks like we have probably the a minimal skeleton crew, but enough to continue our work. Next up, we would ask everyone to review the agenda, the proposed agenda that appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe Connect screen and was circulated to the mailing list by Barry on yesterday. Does anyone have any edits or comments to our proposed agenda? Okay, the queue is clear, so we'll consider that adopted. And finally, are there any updates, modifications, or declarations that anyone would like to make relative to their statements of interest? Okay, thanks. And now that our formalities are done, we can move into item number 3, which is a continuation of our review of the public comments received to our initial report, as well as feedback that we collected during the workshop session in Prague. I don't know that I have scrolling ability. I don't know if that's just me or if that's everyone, but there it goes. Thank you, Mr. Cobb. And it looks like we left off our discussion on page 12 with item number 22. But before we dive in, I think that there were a couple of items that required follow-up. And perhaps, Barry, maybe you can walk us through our homework assignments from last week and where we left off, and if anything remains before we charge forward this week.
Thanks, James. This is Barry. So on comment number 11, James, you had the action item to review the internal processes at GoDaddy with respect to an organizational name change of the registrant. And I think you had sent a response back to the list noting that when there's an organization field change, that the entity is considered the registrant while the name fields are used to designate a contact within the organization. In the event that there's a dispute or confusion between these two, the person claiming to represent the organization with appropriate documentation ID can overrule the individual listed in the name field.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. I think that was one of the questions that was left to us is from last week is how do we untangle those situations where the organization or the individual might be at odds. And I think this is one way to approach it. I think Mr. Nalan responded with a different take on this issue. Michele, can I put you on the spot here and ask you to kind of run through your response to that message and then to see if there's any further discussion required on this topic?
Yeah, sure. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, all we do, it's not that complicated. We just look at it in terms of the account as opposed to whatever data may or may not be and who is. So if the account has been set up for an organization or a company, then we consider anything in the account, be that domain names or hosting or any other services, to be associated with the company or organization as opposed to an individual. So if there's any conflict, then we will take instruction from the organization. It's significantly easier when it's a limited company. It becomes a bit more complicated when you have, which I think in American terms, what you might refer to as a DBA, trading as something, because I'm not sure how it works in the US, but in Ireland and the UK, I mean, a DBA is just a trading name. It doesn't actually have any legal status. So I, as an individual, could have a registered business name, which means I can accept payments as the business name, but it's basically me. It does. So it's just, it's going to be tied back to me as an individual. And that was pretty much
it. I think that's a good point, and I'll just, I don't remember if I responded on the list, but I'll just verbally reply that we used to have something similar to that. My understanding from our team is that we used to have account level controls the way you described. We don't anymore, and I don't know why the change was made or what prompted that change, but it was in the significant past. And I don't mean to pick on Paul Diaz here, but when but he definitely has a wealth of experience here going back to his days at Network Solutions. I remember they used to have the concept of handles, nick handles, to control contacts as well. So I think that there's a lot of interesting ways to slice this one. Chris Chaplow posts, what does DBA stand for? And I believe it's doing business as. And Manetta responded, beat me to the punch there. Thank you. And welcome to the call. I think, McKelly, perhaps where it gets complicated in the Black Knight approach, as you mentioned, is when the organization that is controlling the account is not a legal entity, but just another iteration or manifestation of the individual. So go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, well, the other thing, James, is we would deal with a lot of, how do I describe this? Not-for-profit, loose organizations, clubs, societies that wouldn't legally be incorporated as anything. So, for example, the Carlo Record Collectors something, whether, or I don't know, you know, the Carlo Stamp Collectors Club or something like that. And they don't exist as legal entities.
Mm-hmm.
And what tends to happen there is that the person or officer or whatever that within the organization that handles the bill would probably change from year to year. We also have the same kind of issue arise with schools. So you get I'm trying to think of what's the international term for this, a primary school. A lot of the primary schools, a teacher who knows how to turn on a computer might have been the one who organized hosting and domain registration. So everything ends up possibly associated with them. It's a little bit messy, but going just based on who is would cause other complications, because you'll find sometimes that the domain details might be completely different. Because if you've got, say, for example, a design development company, then they're going to be registering names, hopefully, in their clients' names.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So let's see if we can bring this in for a landing. Comment number 11. I do appreciate, McKelly, your take on that, and it definitely, I believe, substantiates the idea that there's not just one way to approach this issue. That was raised in comment number 11 by the registries, that there are sometimes differences between organizations or individuals, specific name. I think what we are saying here is that whoever, whether in your case, whether it's the account level or in GoDaddy's case, whether it's the organization that demonstrates the necessary documentation listed in the field for the registrant, whoever is currently authorized under the registrar procedures to override or to establish itself as the the entity that is the registrant, would be the entity that would have to authorize or approve any sort of a change of control. I think that sort of brings us back to where we are with comment number 11. Maybe just a clarification is required in our reports to satisfy the registry's question here. Go ahead, Simonetta.
That's what I was wondering. What does this actually mean for us that we are having difficulty to come to some kind of a definition of what a legal entity might be that may or may not have the right to say something that is different from what the registrant information says and who is? Is that what it means, what you just said, that maybe we have to put some comment in the policy that says that based on each registrar's definition of who may or may not have additional rights to make a change, this is what we also want to allow? Is that what we want to put forward, or what does this mean?
My thinking was, thanks, Amanda, my thinking was that we should always try to be as simple as possible, and I think that the RAA and various other documents are fairly clear that whatever organization or individual listed in the registrant field, is the person or entity that's legally responsible, and it's that entity that should approve this change of control. Now, registrars may have their own internal processes to verify who that person is or who's claiming to be that entity or claiming to represent that entity, but I don't think that that needs to be built into this process. I think we can safely piggyback on other definitions, but I'm certainly open to folks who think that that maybe I'm just whitewashing that issue a little bit there. Michele, go ahead.
Now, just the only thing I would say is that, ultimately, let's call a spade, it doesn't matter what may or may not exist in a policy somewhere. If that policy conflicts with your domestic law, is going to win out. I mean, ICANN is not some supranational legislative body that can supersede Irish or European law. So if I am bound under Irish law to do something for a client under Irish law, you cannot turn around to me and say, well, because somebody who didn't really understand the scope of what this policy would, the implications of this policy would have, then, this is what we're going to have. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's just never going to fly. I mean,
I don't think anybody's saying that, though, Michele. I think I don't think it's going down that path at all.
Well, maybe not, but that's just something I just felt like sharing.
Okay. I mean, fair enough. I don't think we're headed in that direction. I think the registries have raised a concern here, and I think we're trying to address it in such a way that doesn't, as Simonetta said, doesn't create a whole bunch of complexities in policy. And then that would, I think, start to head down the path that you're worried about here, where we've got all these asterisks and if-then statements relative to jurisdictions. And I don't think that we're saying that. We're saying that the registrant is still responsible and that the registrant is the party that has to authorize a change of control. But I want to make sure that we are addressing the registry's concerns here. So I've got a queue going here, so I'll go Kevin and then Chris. So, Kevin, go ahead.
This is Kevin Erdman. I'd make a counter comment to Michele's comment, which is ICANN, as a non-government organization, is free to set forth regulations that conflict with national laws. In fact, in many cases where there are different trends in national laws, you don't really have a choice. A system-wide rule is bound to violate somebody's national law somewhere, or something like that. But more to the point, which is, what are the all the registry is worried about, well, I think what it makes most sense is to create a policy that is, number one, relatively fair and easy to implement, because we don't want to create policies in the registration system that unduly tax all the participants with lots of excessive complications. Number two, I don't think you should ignore national law, but, you know, for example, you know, Michele is all caught up in European law, as he should be since he's subject to it, but there's a whole bunch of registries all over the world that are subject to different national laws and have different concerns, and, you know, I think what the main purpose of our group is to develop a policy that, you know, helps the registration system altogether, you know, not one that, you know, picks fights with national laws or anything like that, but I think it is also permissible that if there is a situation where, you know, for example, if we as an organization say, well, this is the way for domain registrations that we're going to identify parties that are able to act on behalf of a registrant that's a non-human entity, these are the things that we need to have happen. We're free to do that. You know, I think it would be better if you make a procedure that isn't obviously going to conflict with a whole bunch of national laws. But on the other hand, you may not be able to make a procedure that is totally compliant with all the national laws that all the registries are going to have to comply with. So, you know, that said, I think we should be mindful of those national laws, but, you know, I don't think that U.S. law or European law or Bolivian law should be the primary motivator in our conversation. So I'll get done ranting, but that's my thought on it.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. And I tend to agree on a number of points. Chris, you're up next.
Thank you. Chris Chapman speaking. Just reading the first part of that comment 11, it doesn't seem to be correct. That's my first impression on reading it, and let me explain why. It says, in cases where the domain name is registered to an organization or a company instead of an individual, the registrant may no longer be employed by the organization. So my first reaction to that would be, well, if the domain was registered correctly in the first place, then the individual would have completed the organization field and put the organization in, whether it be a legal entity or whether it be a DBA. So I just quickly looked up two domains, two whoises actually, that somebody rang me about this morning, both in .com. One of them, looking at the whois, actually domain owner and gives an organization field where he's incorrectly put his name in rather than the organization. And another domain, which they have with a different registrar, there's no organization field at all in the whois. It's registrar, first name, last name, and then street and postcode. So am I missing something here? Are we in a situation where you don't always get the opportunity to put in an organization when you make a domain registration? Because that's sort of an additional problem, isn't it?
Thanks, Chris. I don't know if I have an immediate answer for that. I think that we could probably take a look at the structure of whois for all of the different GTLDs to see what the different fields are and which ones are required, which ones are optional. I think the only one I know of that's optional is fax number. You know, can I maybe just take off my hat here and jump in on this one a little bit here? I think I want to reemphasize or reiterate something that Chris said at the beginning, which is that say if the domain name is registered to an organization or a company instead of an individual, registrant may no longer be employed. I think what we're saying here is that in that case, the registrant, the individual is not the registrant. The individual was a representative of the registrant. The individual was in contact at the registrant. I think in both the model that I described for GoDaddy and the model that McKelly described for Black Knight, this situation has occurred, and we have a system or procedures to account for it. I don't believe, therefore, that this comment from the registry is necessarily new territory, nor do I believe it's necessarily falling within the scope of what we're attempting to resolve here with the change of control. I think that the change of control, like the transfer and like other functions with a domain name, can simply say that the registrant is ultimately responsible, and while that sometimes may not be clear which individual or legal entity is the representative or acting on the behalf of the registrant, I think that registrars have developed procedures that are compliant with their local laws to establish those identities or to document those relationships. So I really don't, I'm concerned that we're going well into the weeds here a little bit and trying to solve a problem that no one asked us to solve. So I'll put my hand down here because that's kind of the end of my rant, but I believe that the registry's premise that a name could be registered to an organization, but then the individual leaves, you know, the name is still registered to that organization. Whoever the new contact is needs to establish that, but I think that that is that registrars have procedures that they've built that that work fairly well in that regard. So I'll go to McKaylee, and then we'll try to button this up here into a response and so we can get into the new comments because we're already now halfway through our allotted time. McKaylee, go ahead.
Yeah, just in relation to what Chris was talking about, I'm not sure whether – I assume, Chris, what you're talking about is when you as an individual or as a representative of a company go to a registrar's interface, be that a web interface or whatever, it's at that point being offered the option to specify an organization. Is that what you're referring to, or are you referring to what I think it was James was talking about, which is that the fields that are available and who is? Because it's in relation to the fields that are available and who is, as far as I know, pretty much all of the GTLDs that I've been able to test whilst James and others were talking do have an organization field in there. If it's in relation to fields that are available to somebody when they go to register a domain name, I suspect that's going to be down to the registrars or their reseller or agent or whatever the hell you want to call them, whatever they've made available on their website. Thanks.
Yes, McKelly, Chris here. I'm assuming that if the registration is done correctly in the first place, then the person on behalf of the organization filled in the organization name or the DBA into that field, and it wouldn't be a major problem if the person changed the organization. It can be dealt with, and that's our response to the comment as a working group. That's based on the assumption that on registration you have the opportunity to put in an organization name, which I'd taken for granted. And if you just do Whois look up on tarifadirect.com, I notice there isn't, but as Steve Minnis has pointed out, it may be something to do with a translation. I don't know why it isn't in an organization isn't in the Whois.
Okay, thanks, gentlemen. Simonetta, go ahead. You may be on mute.
Sorry, I was on mute, yeah. I'm just wondering if really it doesn't matter for us that much how someone would put an organization in a Whois record, for example, or how all of this is done for our... In relation to this comment 11, I think what the intent of the registry stakeholder group was to say, think about this, that maybe it's not just the registrant who's currently in the Whois who is allowed to authorize some kind of a change on this transfer, but think about this also, that it might be necessary that the organization that is in the record, let's say it was successfully put there because the registrar who created this record does support an organization field, then maybe it is an either or, and all we need to do in our policy is say something like the registrant or a qualified or whatever representative of an organization, which we leave it up to the registrars to figure out who that can be according to their local policies, are the ones that can make approval to remove a lock or let a domain name be transferred. Maybe it's as simple as just giving that choice and then leaving it up to the registrars to figure out how they establish who the correct person within an organization is that can make a request to change the registrant to a new employee or something like that.
Okay, thanks, Jimenetta. I think that's a good direction to head in, and if we wanted to saw this off, we would say something like, where we say registrant, maybe a definition early on in our document, so something to the effect of registrant or their authorized representative, and just kind of leave it at that with registrars as they are currently doing today, developing their own protocols, I guess, or procedures to establish that someone is or is not an authorized representative. Okay, the queue is clear. Do we have any other parting thoughts on this one before we move on to the next item of homework? Okay. The queue is clear. Go ahead, Barry. What's the next one?
So just real quick, for the recommended action, basically is just to clarify within the report that the authorized party, albeit a person or an organization, is the only legal entity that can implement a change of control, i.e. registrant or authorized representative.
I think that is good. I mean, we'll probably want to, when we're in the editing phase of our report, we may want to massage that language, but I think it captures the sentiment for now.
Okay, very good. Next homework assignment is row comment number 16, and this is in respect to distinguishing between correcting spelling mistakes or ownership changes. Changing from James to Jim might be the same person, but it could also be someone completely different. In your homework assignment, you had mentioned regarding the treatment of minor updates, we try to make our logic as intelligent as possible. It can be tripped by routine changes, such as changing James to Jim or Incorporated to Inc. As a fallback measure, we always remove any locks that were triggered by changes of this sort.
Right, so that was my homework assignment here to address this question that was raised in the public workshop. And I think our many years of experience in this area have demonstrated that there is no right or wrong place to dial up or dial down the sensitivity of those changes. We have built some basic functionality into our logic that will detect routine updates, but those can always be fooled by false positives. So when those occur, then we usually insert a human being into that process and get their judgment on whether or not that change was substantive or whether it was just a correction of a typo, for example, or a change of a name. It does get a little more interesting when someone changes a name due to marriage, divorce, or other sort of legal name change, because we want to confirm that new person is also the previous person, because otherwise that could be a security vulnerability. But I think that's fairly straightforward, and I think we just ask for identification or something like that that demonstrates that someone is legally known by two names or was in the past. So I think that's just, you know, the update there. I don't know that there is a perfect solution to this. I think we've put in place a relatively workable solution. And I think that this is another one of those areas where registrars would have some discretion to develop their own internal procedures to conform to their customer, their market that they're serving, as well as their local laws. So we'll take a quick cue on this one here. Any thoughts or updates on this, the sensitivity of name changes? Okay. Barry, what's next?
James, so for the recommended action, I'm going to list as none for this.
I think that that's correct. I don't think that there's anything that we can put into policy language that would address this concern. It's just recognize that it is a phenomenon. Of course, unless someone else has any other thoughts, but we could take those to the list.
Okay, great. Our next comment is row 18. And the only action that I got out of this is that the working group would address it again on today's call. This is when you change house or telephone number, you also need to provide proof of ownership, so it is not unreasonable to ask for a similar confirmation in the context of change of registrant. The only thing, I think we briefly touched on this, and the key word out of it was authorization to conduct that change. And I only had that we would just re-review it. If need be, I can go back to the MP3 and try to flush out more details on that one.
Any additional context you can provide I think would be helpful. I'm concerned about this a little bit now, rereading it with the benefit of some time between this and last week's call, that this is starting to sound a lot like some of the proposals for re-verification of Whois data, so that when someone goes into Whois and says, oh, you know, I got a new cell phone, I'm going to put in my new cell phone number, and they enter that into their Whois field, that somehow that the registrar is on the hook to confirm confirm that number somehow, and that it really kind of starts to bog down the process of making any even routine updates or changes to Whois, because they suddenly now have to go through multiple layers of approval and confirmation. I guess I would like some more context there. I think that we certainly don't want to maybe backdoor in some sort of a verification scheme in the context of a transfer policy. But if I'm reading that wrong, if someone please smack me on that one. So what's the next one?
That's it for homework assignments. We'll start back where we left off, which is row 22. This is also from the Prague workshop. The working group may want to consider how the proposed policy aligns with the recently adopted change to the IRTP, which has not been implemented yet, which will require that a domain name registration is unlocked within 5 business days following the request of a registrant.
Okay, thank you, Barry. And I think that as a refresher, what this is saying is that anything that triggers any sort of a transfer lock or any transfer lock that is recommended in our work must also be removable for the work of IRTPB. So I think that any thoughts, concerns, or I think that's a reasonable expectation, but if anyone was coming at this with a different perspective, we'll take a cue on that. Looks like the cue is clear. I think that's a relatively non-controversial point that anything that is proposed in this policy is, of course, subject to other policies. Can we move to number 23?
Great. Okay, we've closed out recommendation one. These comments are with respect to recommendation two, where the working group recommends that the IRTP be revised to insert the following section 2.1.4. Once obtained, an FOA is valid for 45 or 60 calendar days or until the domain name expires, or until there is a change of registrant, whichever occurs first. The first comment is from Michael Shohat. We support such limit and actually have one in place already. Time limit should be multiplications of whole months, 30, 60, 90 days, etc., which are easier for registrants to understand and remember as opposed to fractions of months, i.e. 45 days.
Okay, so unpacking this comment seems to think that, one, the commenter believes that this should be time limited, and two, is proposing some to address one of our questions of how long should the time limit be, and he's giving us some guidance on that. I don't see anything in this comment that discusses whether there's more event-driven limitations of an FOA, such as expiration or change of registrant. So I'll just assume that that he's not weighing in on that issue. Any thoughts or comments on item number 23? Okay, can we move on to number 24?
Okay, comment 24 is by the registry stakeholder group. They support a shorter period such as 30 calendar days or until the domain name expires or there is a change of registrant, whichever occurs first, for an FOA to be valid based on the intent that the existing FOA is to be initiated and maintained by the gaining registrar to document the authorization of the registrant or administrative contact for a transfer to the gaining registrar. Any issues that may delay the successful completion of a transfer authorized by the FOA, such as the unlocking of a domain name or obtaining an auth info code, should be able to be resolved within a 30 calendar day period.
Okay, thank you, Barry. I'll take a cue on this one, and then I'll put myself in the queue because I have a question. I'm the only one. Okay. So this, I think we're on to something here when we say that, you know, an FOA, if one is obtained in advance, for example, let's presume that I have an FOA in my pocket for that was authorized by a registrant of a domain name that's managed by McKaylee's company. And let's assume then that there is a change of registrant. How do I know that that has happened as someone who may be holding on to an outstanding FOA? Certainly the registrar of record cannot be expected to send out notifications because those may not have already been. So do you see where I'm, I don't know if I'm making any sense here, but I think I found perhaps a gap in knowledge or awareness where we're saying, yes, this FOA should expire, but we're not giving anyone any visibility to when those events are occurring. So any thoughts from the group on that? Should we just maybe put a marker here and say we need the further discussions on this? McKaylee, go ahead.
EPPs and other things can expire. I don't see why FOAs can't expire. I mean, as the gaining registrar, I have no way of knowing anything about whether or not the domain name has changed hands or not. So, I mean, I personally, as a registrar, would be a hell of a lot happier if an FOA was only valid for X number of days, and if once that number of days hits the thing, I have to get a new FOA from the person who wants to transfer the domain name to us. But let's face it, if somebody's transferring a domain wants to transfer a domain from Registrar A to Registrar B, they're going to want to do it as quickly as possible. So I don't see any reason why the FOA should last longer than maximum 30 days. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. And I tend to think that that's correct. I just wanted to point out, I think, a shortcoming of the issue of event-driven expiry, because you know, I don't know that the person holding or the person or entity holding the FOA would be aware of that. I think Simonetta pointed out in the chat correctly that this is where the opcode comes in, because the opcode can be reset, and then the person holding the FOA would find out in very short order that their authorization is no longer valid because their opcode doesn't work. But I see a queue for Simonetta and Bob, so maybe we can shed some additional light on this question. Simonetta, go ahead.
I wanted to make 2 points on this. So currently, FOAs, there's no rules around them expiring with any kind of date set, and I understand that some registrars have rules in place that make them live short-lived, and others have rules in place that make them live forever, basically. Also, I think one other comment that came up in the Prague meeting was a little bit about the history of FOAs and how originally they were put there as a means to authorize a transfer, which is really what we're trying to make a new policy for right now. And at that point in time, no one thought about FOAs as something that could be useful in relation to a registrant change at the same time as transfer. So I'm not sure if we're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, or however the saying goes in English. I don't know if this FOA thing is really helping us here as an idea, and we might have to take a look at this opcode piece really as this technical thing that can actually be used for this purpose, that you can reset it when something changes in the registrant, for example, and the losing registrar or the registrar of record who knows that now something has changed in the registrant record can go to the registry and set the opcode to something else, which really then enables the gaining registrar to understand, yes, this transfer is authorized because this opcode is working, or no, this transfer is not authorized because I'm trying to use an opcode that is no longer valid because whoever the previous registrant was made a change to this piece that's on file with the registry that shows the other side that yes, this transfer can proceed or can't proceed. And really, I think we need to think about this distinction and the functionality of an opcode versus what an FOA was originally designed to do, and whether or not this is something that we can still use and need in relationship to a transfer where an owner change happens at the same time.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. And I think that I tend to agree with a number of your points. I think my only hesitation is, do we know that auth info codes are implemented universally across all GTLDs? And if not, then is that what we're saying? But let's go next to Bob. Bob, thanks for joining.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm in a sort of a loud spot, so hopefully there's not so much background noise. I guess the my only comment on 24 would be that not be taken in a vacuum, and we look, you know, make sure we somehow refer to or note the, you know, the subsequent point in recommendation number 3, that, you know, any sort of time limitation also, you know, take into consideration the idea of a modified FOA that we've discussed, which would not necessarily be time limited or subject to the time limits that we're talking about in line 24 here. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Bob. So let's go next to McKelly.
A couple of things. EPP codes are a standard part of the EPP spec, so they're used by any domain extension, both a GTLD or a CCTLD, that is using EPP. Rotation expiry, syntax, and other aspects of EPP keys or codes or whatever the hell you want to call them is something that's handled on a per registry basis. So, for example, some of the ccTLDs use EPP, but you can use the same code for pretty much any domain, which is kind of defeats the entire object of the exercise, but just as a silly example. Coming back to the question here, I thought that we agreed that the change of registrant had to happen either before or after a change of domain of the registrar. In other words, you couldn't have the change of registrant and the change of registrar happening at the same time, because I thought we'd understood that this was causing a lot of the headaches and complications. Or did I miss something? Thanks.
I don't know that we made a hard and fast decision, but I think we identified that that was a special case that introduced a number of issues, and that we were discussing the context of transfer, well, we were saying lock, but we were saying some sort of protections in that use case that were not necessary or useful in other use cases. So I think that we kind of flagged that sequence as being problematic and needing some additional work, but I don't know that we've put anything into ink yet. Simonetta?
Michele, I think the point that you were just making on whether or not we are in agreement on this point is at the heart of what we need to really discuss as a work group when it comes to this process, because I don't think we are completely clear on the best way to approach this. We started the ideal process flow with this idea that, yes, we're going to do it as a sequence. We're going to, for example, always do the registrant change first and then move the name. And then we got feedback, but no, it might be better to allow the other way around as well, because in a lot of cases we're already doing this. And this is not just coming from the aftermarket, which, of course, I would make that statement too, but it came also from the workshop in Prague where people were saying keep it flexible. It could also be the case that someone would want to move the name first and then change the registrant over. And there still is this gray space that we haven't put forward in our initial proposal where it actually does happen both at the same time. And we're just not yet clear on this, but it is one of these things that we as a work group need to really understand and put forward as a proposal so that it will work for all these use cases, that it will work for someone that is interacting as part of an aftermarket scenario or any other use case of when a name moves from one registrar to another and you would want to make this registrant update at the same time. And I'm thinking about UDRP cases and all these other things that can happen. So I don't think we are clear on this, is my response to that question. And this is part of the trouble we're having with a lot of these things, with like who knows when, which FOA to accept and what to set forward as the authorization mechanism and all these things. We're just not clear on that.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta, and thanks, everyone. I wanted to put myself in the queue here just more as a place marker to saw off discussion, because we have a couple of things to chat about before we close the call. We only have about 5 minutes remaining. So real quickly here, looks like we spent the balance of today's call hitting our homework assignment and follow-up from last week, and that's fine, but we still have, looks like somewhere on the order of 8 comments remaining to go through. We have one more session allocated for review of public comments, review and discussion of feedback received, and that is next week, August 21st. After that, we then need to revisit our work plan, but it looks like we then move into further discussion on those points as we work to refine our initial report into a finished product that we can then review, edit, and publish in advance of the ICANN Toronto meeting. There is, of course, a complication, there always is, which is that I will probably be unavailable for next week's call. I know that a number of other folks will be unavailable for next week's call as well. I have reached out to our co-chair, Avery, who is tentatively unavailable as well, although we're trying to kind of work that out right now. So there is a distinct possibility that we may not be able to I see some other folks in the chat room saying that they're going to be out as well. So there's a distinct possibility that our last public comment review session will have to be postponed to August 28th, which we'll have to take a look and see how that impacts our overall work work plan. Just kind of a heads up on that. I don't know that we have any homework or follow-up for this particular call, so next time we will dive right in with item number 25. Which begins to discuss recommendation number 3. Thank you. Barry, I'm sorry. When will Marika be returning?
I don't think she'll be available if we have our meeting next week, but the week after that she will return. I believe she gets back on the 24th. So the 28th is when the working group can expect to see her.
Okay, good news, but, if we had to continue on with you for the remainder of this working group, I don't think anyone would complain about that either. So, we want to hear about her vacation as well. So let's close for there today. Let's note as a working group the strong likelihood, I would say better than 50%, that we do not have a meeting next week and that our next meeting is on the 28th, but work with Barry and Aubrey to resolve that here in the next 24 to 48 hours and see what the availability will be, and maybe we can even send out a doodle poll because if there's no one there, then there's probably no one who would be willing to step in as a temporary chair and lead the discussion. So with that said, I would say thanks, everyone, for your patience in going through these. I think that the public comments public feedback, workshop feedback, is an important component of the ICANN process, and our model is dependent on it, and I really appreciate all of the considered thought and scrutiny that a lot of these comments are receiving and the healthy discussion that they're causing. So thanks, everyone, and we'll look for any announcement on next week's meeting to appear on the mailing list.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, Sammy, and I'll stop the recordings.